Okay, I have 9 o'clock and there's a lot I want to do, so I'm going to get started right away. Right now, if you went to Borough Park or Williamsburg, where on every night of the week the different base medrashes will be full of people, they will be empty, or people will be hanging out front or inside, not learning, talking. People at home will be cleaning their garage, or you might even have some playing cards, doing anything but learning Torah. So the question is, what is going on here? How is it that the night before the most important, or actually maybe Easter is the most important, but it seems to be the most celebrated non-Jewish holiday, Jews refrain from studying Torah? This has got to be the strangest things that Hasidim do, and the Hasidim do lots of strange things, at least from the non-Hasidic practice, and they have been attacked for that. And if you go into a Lithuanian yeshiva, they'll be mocked tonight. They're not learning. You go to a place like Lakewood, people will be learning, but you'll have Hasidic guys there also who won't be learning, and as someone from Lakewood told me once when we were learning Christmas Eve, it's shtus, nonsense. Well, is it nonsense? That's what we're going to see. Some of you might have seen Slate Magazine even had a piece that came out yesterday on this practice. If you know my article on the topic, you'll recognize that he took much of his article from there, but that's okay. Even though I didn't get mentioned, there's been every year there's discussions on this topic. It seems that every year seems to rehash the same old sources. I think I'm going to provide you with new things tonight that even if you've seen my article, maybe you have some new things, but I believe I was able to come up with some new ideas that are not what's usually being rehashed. There's even been a couple books on it, or small books. Here's one that came out a few years ago called Nittel, published by a Satmar Chassid. This book was actually banned. It was taken out of the Sfarim stores. If you read it, you see why. Well, first of all, he quotes people like Mark Shapiro. Believe it or not, he's quoting my article. He called me up about it. He's a guy who already speaks English, even though he's born and grew up in this country. And yet, he's quoting my article. But what got the book banned is not that. It's he seems to have a fascination with Christianity. He's going on all about it. It's one thing to discuss the issues we're going to be talking about today, but when it seems that you're interested in all different aspects of Christianity, for the Satmar, that's not a good thing. Then there's a little pamphlet devoted about it's doesn't have page numbers on many of them, but it's about 60 pages about Nittel. So it's Christmas Eve. Let's talk about this. First, let me tell you that this practice was actually followed in Italy a few hundred years ago. So obviously we're not dealing with some sort of Hasidic nonsense. I mentioned before the Lithuanian yeshivas, so let's clear up something also, that in Lithuania, everyone I've been able to talk to, except for one, affirms that they studied Torah in Lithuania just like any other night. One person mentioned to me that when he was in Baranovich as a young man, and if you know the Baranovich yeshiva, it wasn't a great yeshiva like Mir or Sabudka, it was more of like a high school, even younger for some kids, 12, 13, 14 years old. It wasn't an advanced yeshiva. He claims that they did not study on Christmas Eve. Whether that's true, whether he misremembers, I don't know. But let us examine the practice and its history. First of all, it's not found anywhere in the Talmud. I don't think that would be surprising to anyone. It's not found in medieval rabbinic literature, the notion that you don't study Torah tonight. And it's actually difficult to determine when the practice first began, although I will put forth what I believe to be the best evidence pointing to this, pointing to where it is. Before we even go on, let's talk a bit about the word, that is the Hebrew word Nittel, and also the term Christmas. It's referred to by the rabbis as Nittel, but let's talk about Christmas for a minute. The term Christmas, as far as I can tell, never appears in rabbinic literature, and the reason for this is not hard to see. It's halachically forbidden to mention the name of an idolatrous holiday when this name expresses the idols, the foreign gods, divinity, or lordship. So therefore, this would suffice for most Jews not to mention the name Christmas. Yet contemporary halachas, poskim, all the ones I'm aware of who have been asked this question have ruled that there is absolutely no problem saying the term Christmas, and we're going to be using it tonight. Since it doesn't, what it means is Christ's Mass. It's not referring to an idol or a divinity. It's referring to the Mass of Christ. Yet, I always assumed, and I could see how you can make a case, that nevertheless this should be forbidden, since what does the word Christ mean? Christ means Mashiach. It means anointed one, from the Greek Christos. And since all the early sources talk about how you're not supposed to say a name of a Gentile deity if the name itself implies lordship, Adnut. And if you look, for example, in the Darchei Tshuva, he says that explicitly. It would seem to me, at least, that the term Christ implies that sort of Adnut. And if you're saying Christ's Mass, I would think that would be forbidden. It obviously is forbidden for a Jew to refer to Jesus as Christ, to say things like, instead of using the term Jesus, there's nothing wrong with using the term Jesus, although it's become customary in certain from circles to say things like Yeshua, although the Rambam mentions the name Jesus, so the full name, Yeshua. But Christ, to refer to him as Christ, it means you're calling him Mashiach. I was surprised that Eliyahu ben Amozig, a figure who we're going to deal with in my Monday night's class, does refer to him this way, but I think everyone is in agreement that this shouldn't be done. Yet, I have not found any post that could say there's any problem saying Christmas. And there's actually two responsum on this topic. Or one responsum devoted to this, and another responsum that deals with it. One is Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, where he states explicitly that it's permitted, and the other is a responsum by Rabbi Yitzhak Ratzhabi, a Yemenite rabbi in Bnei Brak. It's in his Sefer Olas Yitzhak. It's actually addressed to me. And he goes through all the details, and he was not convinced of my argument, and so we will use the term. Yet, even if there is not a clear halachic prohibition to use the term Christmas, the fact that it referred to a Gentile holiday, and Jews were accustomed to use derogatory expressions in speaking of elements of the Christian religion, we can understand why they wouldn't use the term. Now is not the time to go into this. We've spoken in my Monday night class. I'm not advocating Jews speak derogatorily about any other religions. However, up until recent years, Jews were persecuted and oppressed by Christians, and they replied through the pen. We're in a different era now, and I certainly think that it's very disrespectful, and we would take great offense if we heard them disrespecting our religions. But what we're doing tonight is an element of intellectual history. Yeah. Now, what's the name for... by the way, it's not only Christmas, or they wouldn't refrain from Jesus. Most of the time, he would not be referred to as Yeshua. He'd be referred to as Yeshu, sometimes with the little squiggly mark, so it would stand for Yimach Shemo V'Zichrono. Simply because, although it's technically permitted to refer to him, Jews didn't want to have anything to do with Christian symbols. And this was much more of an emotional issue in medieval times, when Jews were being persecuted. Many times, Jews were forced to convert. In a way we don't have today, there was a visceral dislike for all elements of Christianity. In fact, Chaim Soloveitchik has pointed out that it would have been very easy for the rabbis, they permitted so much because of economic circumstances, it would have been very easy for them to permit non-Jewish wine. After all, today the non-Jews don't offer their wine. You know, the typical wine you see on the street, it's not offered to idols or anything, and the rabbis were able to permit dealings with the Gentiles, and in opposition to what the Talmud says, because Tosafist says we need to rely on this for our income, etc. And if you know what wine was, it's not like today where wine is just something we drink because occasionally you enjoy it. Wine was the staple. Water in medieval times was unhealthy. People did not drink water. Wine became, if you look in the figures in Soloveitchik's book about how much wine people drank a day and a week and a year, this was the way we drink water, they drink wine. So not having involvement in non-Jewish wine, either selling it or transporting it or drinking it, was a huge economic burden. The rabbis could have found a way. It would have been very easy for them to permit it. And yet, as Soloveitchik points out, this shows the visceral hate, the dislike, the fact that they regarded this as real idolatry, and even if they could have found a way to permit it, they would keep away from it. And this explains why Jesus, even though you can say his name, they wouldn't say it. So what's the name in rabbinic literature for Christmas? The name is Nittel. In fact, Nittel is everything from now, tonight, through tomorrow. This phrase that you hear people use, Nittel Nacht, that doesn't appear in any of the sources. I don't know who invented that, how long ago it was, maybe 50 years ago, maybe more, I have no idea, but this is not the term. There's no term, Nittel Nacht. The term is Nittel, in all the sources. Once again, we don't know when this term Nithil came to be, but it's already found in medieval texts. Rishonim refer to Nithil. So what does the word Nithil mean? There is no doubt whatsoever, that its origin is in the medieval term Natali, Natali Dominis, birth of our Lord, from which the French word, we all know, Noel, is derived. Nevertheless, rabbinic authors do not always know this. Well, they don't always know Latin, especially once you a few hundred years after this, and therefore they displayed great skill in figuring out where it comes from. We're going to see later that Jesus is referred to as the Hung One, Taloi, because in the Talmud it speaks of a figure, Jesus, who almost, there's no question it's Jesus of Nazareth, although some people thought maybe it was a different Jesus, who after he was stoned was then hung. So therefore they associated it with Nithil, the Hung One. And that's, you have to spell it with a tuf. If you want to spell it with a tet, which also, this tied in with the notion of to take something, take away. And you actually have rabbinic authors in recent years that say it refers to Jesus because on Christmas, that's when he was killed. He was taken away. It shows you how some of these rabbinic authors knew so little about Christianity that they didn't even know that Christmas is his birth. Yeah, David, the Chasam Sofer mentions it. We will see the Chasam Sofer in just a minute. If you look in medieval sources, though, the most common way of spelling it is with a tuf. This isn't the only holiday. There's another holiday that it's referred to in Christian sources as Ketzach, Kuf Tzadi Chet. And you'll see rabbis today sometimes, they don't know what this is. And there's even one rabbi, he's published important texts. He's a big rav in B'nai Brak. He thought it referred to Christmas, even. They have no idea what this holiday is. Ketzach, Kuf Tzadi Chet, is Pesach. It's Pascha, it's Easter. However, again, they don't want to say the term Easter, Pesach, or Pascha, so therefore they substitute the letters, and Pesach becomes Katzcha, Ketzach. So if any of you are reading and you see this source, Ketzach, but again, I was surprised. The Rav who mentioned this, as I said, he's a big Rav in B'nai Brak. I don't want to mention his name, maybe, but because maybe it doesn't reflect that well on his, because he's published stuff relevant to this. They didn't know what Ketzach is, but unless you read the early sources, you wouldn't have a clue. Okay, what are the different practices about tonight, not studying Torah? There were those, such as the Munkacher Rav, Chaim Elazar Shapiro, who not only didn't study Torah, he didn't even receive requests from his Hasidim. That's a very big thing for Hasidim, Kvitlech. From midnight, however, Chatzos, the Minchas Elazar Shapiro would study Torah, would do everything that you could do, and this seems to be the unanimous practice. Everyone who's discussed it seems to agree that from midnight on, there no longer is a practice of abstaining from Torah study or any of the other things I'll mention. And Jewish life goes on as normal. Returning to the Munkacher, he wasn't only studying Torah. He even says that there could be no marital relations tonight. We'll get into that in a minute. Unless your wife is returning from the mikvah. Actually, let me correct what I said before. When it comes to marital relations, that the Munkacher said the whole night. Although it doesn't really explain why that is different and everything else only goes to midnight. However, if your wife is coming back from the mikvah, then he says only to midnight. And there's others also. Many Hasidic sources that say the same thing. No marital relations for the entire night. And some even say, if it's the mikvah night. Now, the Minchas Elazar does not tell you what his practice was. If Christmas Eve, let's say tonight was Friday night. We know that this is a dispute among the Hasidic figures. Some believe that even on Friday night, the Rebbe can't speak words of Torah, you can't study Torah, you can't, none of these things. And others felt that the power of Shabbos was able to overcome the evil forces which are present on this night. The evil forces we'll speak about in a few minutes. But there were many who refrained from study even on Friday night. So what are the reasons for abstaining from Torah study? David S. asked me about the Chasam Sofer. Well, the Chasam Sofer says he's one of the earliest to discuss reasons. He might even be the earliest. He says he heard from his teacher, Rav Nosson Adler. The Chasam Sofer had two great teachers. One of them was Rav Nosson Adler, the Mekubal. that Jews are in mourning on Christmas Eve. We're in mourning for all the terrible things done to us. And therefore, we don't study Torah just like a mourner is forbidden to study Torah. And the Chasam Sofer says, well, this would make sense. Because if you look, this would explain why there's no marital relations on Christmas Eve. Because just like a mourner does not have marital relations, so too a mourner does not study Torah. Yet the Chasam Sofer rejects this approach. I'll get to all this. Yeah. The Chasam Sofer rejects this. And he refers to closing the mikveh, which he says was popular, as a minhag shtus, as nonsense. And he says that if the reason for abstaining from Torah study was because we're mourners, then it wouldn't stop at midnight. Not to mention the fact, why couldn't we study now those portions of Torah that a mourner is permitted to study? The Chasam Sofer asks. So the whole thing doesn't make sense. And he doesn't say, but I'm sure he was thinking this, if you're going to say that we're in quasi-mourning, well, what about all the other things you don't do when you're in mourning? You don't take, wash yourself, all these sorts of things. The Chasam Sofer has a different reason. The Chasam Sofer says, if Jews were to study Torah, like we usually do in the evening, at least before we had television and all these things to distract us, Jews after dinner would come back to the Beis Medrash, and they would study Torah. Some would study till 8 o'clock, some would study 9, some would study into the wee hours of the night. However, if we were to study till midnight, which is when people often studied and went to sleep, because you need to wake up the next morning early for work, for minyan, it would reflect bad against them in heaven. Because normally the non-Jews go to sleep earlier than us, we're up studying Torah, and that's fine. However, tonight they have midnight mass. So they purposely are up late. So if we study Torah, let's say, to 11 o'clock at night, and then go to sleep, at midnight, at 1 in the morning, the Christians are up worshiping, doing their worship, and we're sleeping, this would reflect very badly against us in heaven, that the idea that there would be a time when Jews are not involved in Torah study and the non-Jews are involved in their worship. Therefore, the Chasam Sofer says that what the practice, at least his practice is, and what he thinks the practice should be, is that Jews should stop studying Torah early, let's say 7 o'clock, go to sleep, and then wake up at midnight and continue studying. And he says that's why the practice is that it's permitted to study after midnight, precisely because Jews are supposed to sleep until then and then be up studying. So as long as the Gentiles are in their churches and doing their things, we are studying Torah. Note that the Chasam Sofer's reason is lacking any of the mythical elements that we will see in a few minutes. Any of the mythical elements that other writers speak about. According to him, there's nothing special about Christmas Eve. Any day that the non-Jews decided they're going to start studying Torah, start praying to their God, at midnight, we wouldn't want to be sleeping at that time. Although it's hard to imagine that the Chasam Sofer went to sleep, he probably stayed up continuously. A gedolim like him don't seem to need a lot of sleep, but this is what he says. There's another explanation for the practice, another, quote, rational explanation. And this is offered by a 19th century Maskil, mid-19th century. His name is Zweifel, Eliezer C. Zweifel. And I bet you've all heard this explanation, because it becomes very popular. According to Zweifel, in medieval times, there was an increased danger of violence against Jews on Christmas Eve, and therefore the rabbis ordained that no one was supposed to come to the house of study. Now, as I said, this has become a very popular reason. People don't realize that it was stated by a Maskil, although I will tell you that Zweifel was not like other Maskilim. He actually had a more of a positive view, a sympathetic view to Hasidim. Why did this rational reason become so popular? Well, let me tell you. First of all, it's found in a work called Likutei Tzvi, which is basically a Haskalah text that has Zweifel's notes on the back. You can find this on HebrewBooks.org. It's on there until they discover that it's a Haskalah work, and then they'll remove it. So anyone who's interested, download it to your computer. But who read the Likutei Tzvi? No one read it. However, this explanation was picked up by the work Tamei HaMinhagim, a very popular work, especially not only in the Hasidic world, but especially in the Hasidic world, but in all the Jewish world. And it was cited by mistake, I think by mistake, although maybe on purpose, in the name of a work, Likutei Pardes. Now, what's Likutei Pardes? Likutei Pardes is a work from collection of Rashi's, a text of Rashi. There's nothing in there about Nittel in the Likutei Pardes. However, it was quoted in the Tamei and Minhagim. It became very famous, and this became a traditional explanation, especially for the Misnagdic world, for those who are opposed to Hasidim, explaining why Jews refrain from studying Torah Christmas Eve. And therefore, since we don't need to worry about going out at night, it's foolish and stupid not to study Torah tonight. It's Bittul Torah. People, you find this cited all the time, and it's always cited in the name, or often cited in the name of Likutei Pardes. Sometimes they just cite it without saying who they got it from. And usually, they don't tell you they got it from the Tamei HaMinhagim. Only very few people actually tell you they looked for this book, Likutei Pardes, and they looked through the book, and they looked for other books, and they cannot find this mentioned. So very few people actually go back and try to find this. I think it's probably a typo. Instead of Likutei Tzvi, it's Likutei Pardes, but there's also a possibility that the author of Tamei HaMinhagim doesn't want to cite a maskil. He sees a good explanation. He doesn't want to cite it from a Haskalah text, so therefore he changes the name of the text. In any event, you should know that all these big rabbis who would never dream of citing a maskil, they're citing the Likutei Pardes, which is really the Likutei Tzvi. Now, were there bad things that happened to Jews on Christmas Eve? I guess sometimes there were bad things. In fact, the Hasidic master, Ritzvi Elimelech of Dinov, the Dinover, records that there were terrible things, and one example he gives is that some people tried to study Torah tonight, and a dog appeared in front of their house. Now, you and me might not think that's a terrible thing. What, we look outside and we see a dog standing in front, but know what a dog meant in the mystical atmosphere of Eastern Europe, the Hasidic world. If you're ever wondering, you know, why is it that the Hasidim... not just the Hasidim, it's really the whole Haredi world, but especially the Hasidim, don't have dogs. I mean, we know that Muslims don't have dogs. Muhammad didn't like dogs, but, you know, dogs, man's best friend. I've had dogs my whole life. The dog I grew up with my whole life was named Yontif. Like, there was a dog in Vacation Village when I lived there named Muksa. It's a subject for another talk, but Cyrus Gordon, actually, and Cyrus Adler, president of JTS, had a dog whose name was Caleb. But I mention that because what is a kelev? In numerous Hasidic texts, a dog is a very bad thing. First of all, if you're a really bad guy, you're going to be returned as a reincarnation and as a dog. A malek, the symbol of a malek, is the dog. But there's more here. What's the gematria of dog? Kelev. 52. That's the gematria of Ben, son. And you have all these Kabbalistic... speculations here that the dog, the kelev, represents son, Ben, and Jesus is the son, that it, as it were. God, the Christians refer to him as the son of God, but he's the son from the impure side. This is related. They're not saying that Jesus is actually the son of God, but they're using the language of son and speaking to him as son from the impure side, which is symbolized by Kelev, the gematria, his son. And I have more information on this. Maybe I'm going to continue eventually on the Sorian blog, posting about Christianity. I'll get more into that. But that's why the symbol of a Kelev. Okay, very good. Yet all this is in the realm of the supernatural. And has nothing to do with the practical explanation suggested by Zweifel. Indeed, if you look in the Dinover, what he says is preceded by a Kabbalistic analysis of the name Jesus. And he says, why don't you study Torah Christmas Eve? Because of the Klipa, the impure forces that are associated with Jesus. They're very powerful tonight. Okay, let's return, though, for a minute to the comments of Zweifel. It must be emphasized, I think, that although Zweifel gives a nice speculation, this only would explain why the Beis Medrash would be closed. It says nothing about why you wouldn't study Torah in your house at home. Since everyone was supposed to stay at home, what are they supposed to do at home? Why not study Torah? But they didn't study Torah. If Zweifel's explanation was correct, you'd have to assume that because people were told to stay home, they mistakenly assumed that Torah study was forbidden at all. The whole thing makes no sense. Fine, you can't go to the Beis Medrash. So you're going to stay at home? Not to mention the fact, there's no evidence whatsoever that the Beis Medrash was ever closed officially. For public prayer was never banned. If it was dangerous to go out, you wouldn't have had public prayer. There's no reasons why Jews would have been more in danger on Christmas Eve than they would have been in Easter. We've never had any, we have no evidence that public prayer was ever banned, that Jews were told to, stay home, daven at home, anything like that. All this leads me to doubt that, quote, rational reasons have anything to do with this practice. As I'm going to try to explain, this has nothing to do with, quote, rational reasons. Now, there's no shortage of mystical, mythical reasons to explain why Torah study doesn't take place tonight. Chabad texts agree with the Dinover that if you study tonight, you'll increase the vitality, what they call the chayos, of the klipos. There are these, the Hasidim assume, and then there are these evil forces have been let loose tonight. And we still don't have to understand that why does our studying Torah give strength to the evil forces? You know, you'd assume just the opposite. That if there are evil forces, by us studying Torah, we'd be able to triumph over the evil forces. So it's a little counterintuitive. Let's go further, though. The Belzer, the Sar Shalom of Belz, had his own reason, which is as follows. The Talmud says that when you're with someone, before you leave them, before you say goodbye, you should finish with a matter of halacha, have a little halacha discussion, because then you'll be able to remember him by. And this was actually supposed to be interpreted by the Besh, the Baal Shem Tov, as follows. Not just with regard to a person. Don't take leave of God unless you're going to be studying halacha. For only if you're studying halacha, studying Talmud, can you lose some of your devekos, your connection to God. So when the Talmud says, don't take leave of a friend unless you're studying, the Baal Shem Tov said, don't take leave of your devekos, your connection to God, unless you're going to be studying. Because that's the only reason you're permitted to lose some of your connection to God. Because if you're involved with godly things, and now you're leaving this devekos, this close connection, at least study Torah. I hear what you're saying, but I still don't understand. Well, wait till the end. We'll get back to it. By the way, so Rav Sholem of Belz explains that even though this is true on all nights of the year, Christmas Eve, in other words, on every night of the year, or any time, when you decide you're involved in Devekos with God, cleaving connection to God, and you decide to leave it, that you should involve yourself in Torah study. However, Christmas Eve is special, because on Christmas Eve, the Sitra Achra, the forces of darkness, are very powerful. So therefore, rather than studying, which means lessening our devekos, we should instead strive for an elevated devekos. So it's not that we don't connect to God tonight. It's that by studying Torah, we'd be doing less. For the Hasidic thinkers, study of Torah and devekos are really opposing elements. According to them, when you're studying, you don't have devekos. So therefore, we have to study also sometimes. So when when we leave our devekos, then we study. But Christmas Eve is special. We can't study Talmud because if we're studying Talmud, we're getting involved in all these other issues here, and that's not the most important thing for a chassid. So Christmas Eve, you must spend your time in devekos. At least that's what he claimed. The fact is that maybe most of his sitting probably didn't, but usually in these sort of things, it's enough for the Rebbe. If the Rebbe's involved in devekos, the Rebbe's not playing cards or anything, that's enough to keep his whole congregation safe. Since I mentioned the Besh, let me just call attention to we spoke before about the marital relations tonight. The Besh mentions, and others, that that's what's so dangerous about tonight. Apostates, because the evil forces are out tonight, you do not want to cause a conception tonight. And the Besh even said that many apostates were born out of marital relations from Christmas Eve. I guess they have the Sitra Achra, the evil soul, is born into them. And that's what leads them to Christianity. I'll get to that, Ovadia. So obviously, evil powers are at work tonight. Now, this doesn't work for the Misnagdim, this explanation Rav Sholem gave. If you're a non-Chassid, if you're a Misnagid, and you want to get close to God, Dafka, the special way you get close to God is by studying Torah. But for the Hasidim, they have a different take on this. We actually know, though, that it's not just the Hasidim. non-Hasidim, Talmudists, they also didn't study tonight. So there's nothing, there's more to it than that. Okay, since Avadia raises the point here, let me just mention the date of Christmas for a minute. When should we be observing this? Some held that Torah study should cease tonight, December 24th, while others held that it really should cease the night of the Julian calendar, which is in, I don't know what it's going to be in the 21st century. In the 20th century, it was January 6th most of the days. It's not that they celebrate Christmas on January 6th. It's still December 25th for them, but they never adopted the Gregorian calendar, which 10 days were added. I forget the year. It's the 1500s, and those days didn't have dates. They just were added. That was for astronomical reasons. Because every year, every century, like, they lose a day, because a year is not exactly 365 and a quarter days. So the Russian Orthodox Church and others, they kept to the old Julian calendar, so their December 25th is actually in our January. Those people who lived in the Russian Empire, in the Russian Orthodox lands, the Greek Orthodox lands, they observed it in those days. January 6th. For people in Roman Catholic lands, they did it December 24th. And there were those who observed it on both days. Obviously, this is what we know as a Sfeika Dioma. There's a doubt as to which day you should observe. So just like by our holidays in Chutz Laaretz, we observe both days, so therefore you observe both days. The prevailing opinion is that you do in accord with the people around you. If you're in a Western Christian country, it's tonight. And one of those, by the way, who mentions that he observed both days was a former Dayan on the Eda Haredis. His name was Avram David Horovitz. He's a Hungarian Rav. And he explains as follows the reason. This is what he was told when he was young. We don't study Torah because we might study something that Jesus studied, or Jesus might have had an interesting insight, and we might come to that and study that. And this will be of assistance to his soul that remains in hell where it's being punished. We'll get back to this idea in a little bit. First of all, this is related to a concept in the Talmud that if you repeat a Torah novelet, a Torah insight, in the name of someone else who's no longer alive, it says his lips move in the grave. That is, he gets some benefit for it. So this desire to prevent Jesus from getting some benefit, that we could learn something that he learned, is so great that, according to this Rabbi Horovitz, even if Christmas Eve fell on Shabbos, he wouldn't study Torah. Okay, so what are you supposed to do if you're not studying Torah? Playing cards is a popular thing. It's often mentioned, playing cards. If you look at the encyclopedia, the Jewish Encyclopedia, there's no entry on this in the Encyclopedia Judaica, but there is an entry on the old Jewish Encyclopedia, which, although over 100 years old, is still valuable. You can find it all online now. There's an article by Gotthard Deutsch, a big scholar, and he writes, quote, "It was also customary among the Jews to play cards on Nittel night, which was explained as being done in opposition to the solemn attention of that evening by Christians, while really it was merely a survival of the old German custom of merrymaking at this festival." Now, Deutsch doesn't say anything about abstaining from Torah study, but obviously he'd explain it the same way, that this was traditional German merrymaking, and therefore Jews took part in it. I'm going to say a lot more about this dubious assumption soon. The idea that Jews in the yeshiva, traditional Jews in the yeshiva, would stop playing cards because the goyim are making merry tonight strains the imagination. Although, we do know that some did. I'm talking about the rabbis. You can't imagine the rabbis doing that, but we know that people did play cards, and the Chasam Sofer mentions it. And he says he was able to abolish it in his community. Yeah. You asked a good question. You know, this whole date, by the way, you have Christmas. Christians themselves know he wasn't really born on this day. This used to be an old pagan holiday. And they didn't settle on December 25th. I think it was to the 3rd or 4th century. First day they celebrated in March. It's possible that they have a tradition from their from the assumption that it took place on March 25th. So they count 9 months later and say December 25th. And it doesn't really, as I said, celebrate anything, because there's these 10 days that they added. So it's more symbolic. But it's not a question of the date. It's the question of when, Terry, it's a question of when the Christians are involved in their worship, according to many. Although, for some, it is the date. For some, the date itself, when he was born, has evil forces. Yeah, that's correct, Henry. Okay, let's now talk about when this practice originated. because it's currently the Hasidim who follow this. In fact, I think it's only the Hasidim, or mainly at least, it's been suggested by many people that it originated with the Hasidim. We will see in just a minute that this is completely not true. Clearly predates the Hasidim. How much it predates them remains to be determined. When we determine how much it predates them, we'll be better able to understand the true reason for the practice. Now, I decided to investigate this practice about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and I decided to look at the writings of Jewish apostates. What I mean by Jewish apostates? In the 1500s and the 1600s, 1700s also, you have a lot of conversion from Judaism to Christianity in Germany. And many of these authors write about their experiences growing up Jewish. These texts are written in Reformation-era German. The books are very rare. I checked earlier this week. Almost all the ones I cite in my article are not even online. Some are online, but most are not. So that shows we still have a long way to go. I was fortunate to be in Cambridge, and I had Harvard's great Houghton Library, which had almost all these texts, and some which I didn't have, I needed, were sent to me on microfilm from Germany. The Harvard Library ordered me these things. At that time, to my knowledge, only one person had ever looked at these sources. It was a man, he lived in Brookline, named Joseph Collier. I know nothing about him. He published an article in the Jewish Quarterly Review in the 60s. I assume he was at used the Harvard Library. He published one article, not about Nittel, just about Christmas Eve, about the description of Jewish practices by the apostates. They give us a lot of insight into what was going on in the community. Elisheva Karlbach has subsequently written a whole book on the topic. Here's the title page. Came out, I think, in 2002. She wrote an article prior to that on the topic, and I was happy to see that she writes that the way I use the sources is a model for how to use the apostate literature, and I thank her for saying that. I hope, at least I'm glad that a scholar of her caliber thought that I accomplished something. But before I knew there was anything in there about Nittel, I said, let me look in these sources. I was curious about the custom, because every year people write about this, and no one's actually getting any further. They're just rehashing. It's almost like every year, Hanukkah time, Pesach time, books come out, and they don't say anything new. They just rehash the old stuff. I wanted to see if I could get to something earlier. Was this mentioned before? Rabbi Griska, just save it to the end. You say it's a very good point. If I don't answer your point, we'll have discussions at the end. All right, when I look at these texts now, I have a very difficult time reading them. I took Reformation German class at Harvard, and I used to be able to read these texts very well. Don't let anyone tell you that when you don't speak a language, you forget it, but you always keep reading. Remember, if you read it, you never forget. I look at these texts, and it's very difficult. But like I said, at one time, I read them very well. It's already 15 years ago. Now, these sources, though, which we'll speak on in a minute, first of all, you need to use them very carefully. Some of these authors turned anti-Jewish, and the point of their writings is to portray the Jews in the worst possible way. But others don't have these negative feelings, and they don't portray the Jews this way. Now, there is a most significant passage which does not mention the study of Torah on Christmas Eve, but it does mention Christmas Eve practices, and it appears in the writings of the notorious apostate Johann Pfefferkorn. Pfefferkorn is famous. He got into the great dispute with Reuchlin. He wanted to destroy all the Talmuds, and Reuchlin wanted to oppose that. So you have to be very careful in what you read in Pfefferkorn. He did, however, defend the Jews against the blood libel. He tells us that Jews secretly read Toldos Yeshu on Christmas Eve. What's Toldos Yeshu? It's a text. It's not a medieval text. It goes back further than that, although when it was first written down, we don't know. It goes back to Talmudic times, a text describing all sorts of negative things about Jesus. And Pfefferkorn says that Jews had a practice of secretly reading Toldos Yeshu on Christmas night, and Toldos Yeshu was passed around throughout Europe, places like Germany. It was not printed, it was handwritten, and we know this from other sources, and Jews kept it secretly. He says, quote, "They maintain and believe that the Lord Jesus, published by God because of his apostasy and false teaching, has to wander in all pits of excrement or latrines throughout the world on that night. Thus did I learn and believe unthinkingly from my youth on. When it was Christmas Eve, I urinated outside of the privy because of worry and fear of the hanged Jesus, for he was acting in a filthy way that night. We see a similar accusation 7 years later by another apostate named Ernst Ferdinand Hess. Let me show you the title page of his book. This is one of the few that's online. He says the same thing. So what is this idea that Jesus is condemned to crawl through latrines on Christmas Eve? Where does it come from? We're going to see this repeated over and over again. The closest parallel is told us Yeshu, where it says that after his death, he was dragged around the streets of Jerusalem. Another version of told us Yeshu has Jesus trampled to death when he falls from the sky. Actually, the reason he fell from the sky is because he was flying up there. He had God's holy name, and one of the great rabbis also who knew God's holy name flew, and he flew above him and urinated on him, and that made Jesus impure, and Jesus fell to the ground, and then he was killed. That's what it says. I believe in this book, Nittel, he has even... I believe it's in this one, not the other one. He actually reprints the Todos Yeshu. And he's, after his death, he's placed in a latrine. Ah, Jonathan, I'm getting to that. Excellent. After his death, he's placed in a latrine. Do these accounts of Pfefferkorn and Hess have any relationship to Todos Yeshu? I'm not clear, but one thing it is relevant, and that's what Jonathan just points out, is a passage in Gittin 57a. It's censored. However, it's in the uncensored versions. It talks about, and I think this is probably the notion, the origin of the notion, that Jesus has to crawl through the latrines. According to this passage, it's been decreed in heaven that Jesus is to be punished with boiling hot excrement. That's his punishment. Thank you, Jonathan. By the way, all these Talmudic passages about Jesus, all the terrible things said about him, have been analyzed in a very recent book by a non-Jewish scholar from Princeton. He came from Germany to Princeton a few years ago, a great, great scholar who's not Jewish. Peter Schaefer. He's an expert on the so-called Hegel literature, which are these mystical texts from the rabbinic period. He's an expert in, let's say, Hasidei Ashkenaz. I think he's probably the greatest expert of things Jewish, that is, the greatest non-Jewish expert of things Jewish. I was actually at Princeton just a month ago. I chaired a session. I had a whole conference, 2.5 days, on Todos Yeshu. Had I had time, I would have spoken about Todos Yeshu in recent rabbinic literature, but I didn't have time, so I chaired it. And there's a lot of scholarship we have in different languages. We have old texts of it. But this is his book on the Jesus traditions in the Talmud. Pfefferkorn and Hess, neither of them make reference to study of Torah on Christmas Eve, that is, abstaining from study of Torah. This can only be because they didn't know the practice. It's clear that both of them were unaware of it. The first reference to abstaining from Torah study on a Christian holiday is by another apostate named Johann Adrian, and he does the same thing about the latrines and that, but he doesn't mention anything about Christmas. He says Ascension Day. That Jews did not study Torah on Ascension Day? Now, in my article, I said, well, this makes sense, because Ascension Day is the day that Jesus goes up to heaven, so therefore it makes sense that on that day, Jesus would want to protest this, actually, and they would think that this is a terrible day, and this is a... But now I don't think so. And Baruch Oberlander, the rabbi of Budapest, Chabad Rav, has convinced me of this. First of all, Jews don't know what Ascension Day is. Jews know Christmas, they know Easter, they don't know Ascension Day. I believe this is probably an example of an apostate who misremembered from his youth. Really, he's speaking about Torah study, but here we have Johann Adrian. His book is published in 1609, and he's writing about Jews who refrained from Torah study. So that really predates the rise of the Hasidim. Now, we know, what is this business of Jesus, though, on earth? Well, there are some texts, rabbinic texts, that speak about the saints and also the wicked returning to Earth sometimes during the year. Shabbos, the new moons, and Sukkot. I don't know of any sources, however, that speak about the wicked returning on a yearly basis. And furthermore, it's unclear what's the connection between Jews studying Torah and Jesus getting a reprieve from his difficulties. It's hard to know, but there seems to be some connection. In any event, there's something mysterious about Jews studying Torah. Now, all of these authors, Pfefferkorn, Hess, Adrian, they're writing independently of each other. In fact, the first two, as I mentioned, don't even mention studying Torah on Christmas Eve. There is no evidence that this practice predates the 1500s. Adrian, writing in 1609, he mentions the practice of abstaining from Torah study. Shortly after him, other writers do. However, before him, and contemporaneously with him, other apostate writers don't mention this at all. It can only be that they did not know about this practice. Their whole point was to make the Jews look bad, many of them, and talk about the bad things Jews do on Christmas and what they say about Jesus. They certainly would have mentioned this if they knew about it. We can only know this by looking at the apostate text. You can't look at the Jewish text, for example, and say that they don't mention it. Before the Chasam Sofer, none of them mention it, really. Although we have at least one or two mentions, but they don't describe it in detail. That's because you can't expect a book of Jewish customs like the Maharil or the Leket Yosher to be discussing this. This would be dangerous to put in print. It's dangerous if the non-Jews were to find out about anything like this. So the Christians wouldn't know about it, but the Jews certainly would know about it. I don't want to go into it, but there's numerous other famous apostates. Here's another one, by the way. Here's his title page. Anton Margarita is his name. He published his book in Augsburg, Germany, in 1530, Der ganz jüdische Glaube. He's trying to tell you everything there is to know about Judaism. He goes through all the holidays, everything. His father was a rabbi. His grandfather was a rabbi. Both of them were rabbanim. His father, Shmuel Margolios, and his grandfather, Yaakov Margolios, were both the Rav of Regensburg, an important German Jewish community. This is the household that Samuel Margolios, no, he becomes Margarita, grew up in. He obviously is fully aware of everything that happens in the Jewish world, the Jewish community. And by the way, scholars can look at these works. Benjamin Hamburger from B'nai Brak, I don't think he uses this one, but he has a whole book, 3 or 4 volumes on practices of the Minhagim, the customs of Germany. He uses these German texts like this. He uses Schutz texts and other texts because they provide evidence of certain practices that we don't have in traditional sources. Now, Margarita is intent on showing how anti-Jewish, how anti-Christian Judaism is. And yet, he mentions nothing about Torah study Christmas Eve. In 1614, the apostate Shmuel Samuel Friedrich Brenz accuses Jews of anti-Christian activities. He writes as follows. The Jews also consume much garlic, particularly on Christmas Eve. If one asks the reason, the answer is so that the tola, that is the hanged one, is dishonored, or that they might, that the Jews might stink more. They inform their servants that God has imposed upon Jesus that on Christmas night, when the Christians are more devout than any other night, he must crawl through all the latrines. In this same Christmas night, the Jews are very merry and spend their time playing, eating, and drinking. The reason they give is that the Tola, that is the hung one, has a better rest in the house in which they study and pray. Therefore, by avoiding this, he's not able to crawl through the corners of these houses, but must remain in the latrines. Earlier in his work, Brenz claimed that on Christmas Eve, Jews secretly read Toldot Yeshu. Now, Brenz's account is independent of all the other accounts. We have here the same idea that Jesus crawls through with the latrines, although I don't know if this still survives, this idea among the Hasidim. And we also have the idea that by Jews studying Torah, he mentions even praying, but I think this means sort of he's exaggerating, he's just including all of them together. That Jesus somehow is given certain rest. Another apostate, Dietrich Schwab, writing shortly after that, says similarly, and he goes further, he says that Jews would say, while the Christians are in church, Jews would utter these blasphemous words, now the mamzer crawls through all the latrines. They even say that there's banging in the house, and they tell the children not to go into the bathroom. this appears to be more than folklore. It appears to be a real fear that there's problems in there. You don't want to go in there. And Jews were afraid. Already the Talmud speaks about that the latrine was thought to be a place of evil spirits, of difficult things going on in there, dark things happening in there, impure forces. By the way, the idea that Jews would not go into the latrine, this is also mentioned by another person. Very, very learned man. Unfortunately, a terrible anti-Semite. Johann Eisenmenger. He wrote two huge... Well, let me first show you the title page. He wrote two giant volumes, each one of about 1,000 pages, called Indectus Judentum, Judaism Uncovered. These books are published in the 1700s. They are literally this thick, 1,000 pages each. When I was at Harvard, these works were still on the stacks. You could take them out and take them home. This is, you can find online, by the way. When I was there, it was incredible. You had books from the 1700s, which were just there to be taken out. Johann Eisenmenger is one of the greatest bekeim of rabbinic literature imaginable. He has read it all. I'm not comparing him, obviously, to Torah scholars, but great Torah scholars, but certainly mediocre Torah scholars. Every page of his work, 2,000 pages, is full. Here you just want to give an example, if you could see, of citations from standards. He knew Shas. The man knew all of Shas. I'm not saying he knew, he could explain the difference between Tosis' view and Rashi's view when it comes to understanding Malach or anything like that, but simply knowing the pages. He had been through every page in Shas. He knew Rishonim. He knew the contemporary figures. He knew the Kabbalistic literature. The man's knowledge is incredible. I picked up sources from him. And of course, he actually thought that the blood libel was true, and he was all about making troubles for the Jews. But in his works also, you can find a lot of important things and a lot of truthful things. And he mentions that he actually observed this in Frankfurt, where he lived, that they didn't want to go to the bathroom, the outside, that is the enclosed privy. They'd go, I guess they'd find behind a building or something, but they would not go inside the latrine. It's clear that what we have are a number of independent and truthful accounts of Jewish practices with regard to Christian holy days. Well, in particular, what we focused on is Christmas Eve. The fact that they disagree in certain matters, one with the other, show that they weren't copied. And these are sources coming from apostates who describe what they saw when they were young. This doesn't mean, as I said, that you always trust an apostate. But where there's good reason not to doubt their information, it should be accepted as valid, especially when what the apostates tell you is confirmed by Jews. And we will see that what the apostates tell us is confirmed by Jews. All right, just looking at the time, we'll probably go to about 10:15, because I'm not going to be done in 7 minutes. There's another interesting point, by the way. Remember what Bren said, that Jews eat garlic on this night? I know of no other contemporary source that records this practice. But there appears to be no reason to doubt it, especially since Jewish writers in the 20th century, that is, rabbinic writers, have confirmed that even in recent generations, people have done this. One writer reports that garlic breath, you know why you had garlic breath? Because it discourages marital relations on that night. Because you have bad breath, no one wants to get near one another. The problem with this explanation, however, is already the Talmud speaks of garlic as an aphrodisiac. Something to be consumed Friday night. So I don't know what to make of that, unless he would say, well, that's actually having eaten the garlic, but it doesn't mean you have garlic breath. But I mean, that's what he says. I think, however, there might be another reason to explain the consumption of garlic on Christmas Eve. We've already seen how fearful Jews were of coming into contact with Jesus on that night. Well, what so happens that the smell of garlic was a well-tested method of keeping demons away. And it's not unlikely that the same method would have been used to keep Jesus away. I think even in one of the Dracula movies, they use garlic. People put garlic around their doorposts to keep out the demons. This was a way to keep the bad forces away. So what better way to keep Jesus away than garlic? After all, you're certainly not going to, like with Dracula, hold up a cross in front of him. So garlic. Now, it's true that all the sources that discuss garlic as keeping away demons speak about it in terms of carrying it or placing it in certain places, but this doesn't eliminate the possibility that people also thought that if you eat it, that could help you. I don't know if there still is a practice. There used to be a practice of Jews going to the cemetery on Tisha B'Av. They would carry garlic in their pockets so that the evil forces in the cemetery couldn't attack them. Now, this book by Brenz created quite a storm when it was published. And a contemporary of his, Zalman C. of Althausen, authored a book, a polemical work, designed to refute all the accusations against Judaism made by Brenz. Now, if you read Rav Zalman's work, it's written in a tongue-in-cheek fashion. It's a perfect example of disingenuousness found in religious disputations. As Professor Daniel Lasker, who studied a lot of, he's done a lot, he wrote the book on Jewish philosophical polemics against Christianity in the medieval times, in the Middle Ages, and he's an expert on Jewish polemical literature, he's fond of saying that all's fair in love and polemics. Because if I'm involved in a polemic, I really don't have to speak the truth. My whole point is to score points. So therefore, you have all sorts of polemical and apologetic writing where Jews say things that the Jews know are not true. But yet they say them anyway to make a point or to win the argument. One great debate regarding this has to do with the Ramban. The Ramban, in his famous debate against Pablo Christiani, says when he was challenged about certain Maggadic texts that seem to imply that the Messiah had already been born, and therefore how could the Jews say that they're waiting for the Messiah, the Messiah has already been born? The Ramban says, I don't accept that. We're not obligated to accept Midrashim and Agadas. And there's a big debate. Did the Ramban really mean that? Or was the Ramban just saying this to score points, or to, as the Talmud says, to push away with a reed? If you look in the first pages of all sorts of books published in Europe in the last few hundred years, they say on the very first page that all our discussions about the non-Jews, non-Jewish religions, don't relate to the non-Jewish religion that we live among, or the non-Jews we live among, and relates to the non-Jews living in India and their pagan religions. But all Jews know that wasn't true. So this idea that in the context of polemics and debates, you didn't have to speak the entire truth, that was taken for granted. Moshe Feinstein makes that very point, that that the biggest proof that you can distort the Torah, unlike the Marshal, Rav Shlomo Luria said it's a capital offense to distort Torah for any purpose whatsoever. Moshe Feinstein says all you have to do is look at any sefer, and you see they're distorting Torah all the time. That shows you if it's a matter of life and death, you're permitted to distort Torah, unlike what the Marshal said, that we're forbidden to distort Torah. And therefore, in what can probably be described as sheer dishonesty, Rav Zalman says he denies that Jews did anything out of the ordinary on Christmas Eve. Now, I understand this could be an issue of pikuach nefesh, of saving Jewish lives or preventing them from being economically affected. So he's permitted to lie. But he denies that Jews had any Christmas Eve practices. He says if you saw them when maybe rejoicing or playing cards or anything like that, it's because it must have coincided with Hanukkah. But if it doesn't coincide with Hanukkah, the Jews do nothing out of the ordinary Christmas Eve. And what about the garlic, that Jews would eat garlic on that night? He says that since they didn't have any business that day, therefore they weren't going to be involved with the non-Jews, it wasn't a problem to have bad breath, and therefore they had no problem eating garlic. Needless to say, these are not exactly compelling explanations. Rav Zalman, however, he's in the early 17th century. He's the first Jewish source to mention the practice of nittel. And he denies it, but he's the first one to deal with the notion that Jews did anything different. Shortly after him, maybe 50, 60 years after him, the German halachist, the Chavos Yair, Rav Yair Chaim Bacharach, he mentions nittel. And this work has only been recently published, the last 20 years. He has a book called Makor Chaim, which is a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And at the beginning of it, he has something called Kitzer Halachot, which is it's an index of what was contained in a larger work, but the larger work hasn't come down to us. And in commenting on that, the section of the Shulchan Aruch, which discusses establishing a set time for Torah study, which should never be missed, The Chavos Sira writes as follows, quote, Uminhag bito harimud b'leil chog aploni. And the practice of abstaining from Torah study on the night of their holiday. So he tells us that in his larger work, which is Lost, he discusses this. However, we don't have the larger work, so we don't know what he says. Notice that he calls it a chogah. Chogah is the way that we don't call it a chag. A chogah is how you refer to a pagan festival. So you call it a chogah. Well, from the sources I've mentioned so far, it's obvious that the practice of abstaining from Torah on Christmas Eve has an early origin, dating back into at least the 16th century, the 1500s. The fact that it's not recorded in Hebrew literature from this time led to the notion that it's a late practice, perhaps established by the Hasidim. However, even before the publication of the Makor Chaim of Bacharach, the evidence was there in the apostate literature, if anyone bothered to look at it. Now, the difficulties this would have created had the non-Jewish world known about this practice, explains why Jews did not record it in print. It was, however, a popular oral tradition that all Jews knew about in 16th century Germany, 17th century, 18th century Germany. However, things changed in Germany. It became a more of a rational type of place. The practices were forgotten. Even the traditions were forgotten in Germany. Yet they remained alive and well in the more mystical atmosphere of Eastern Europe among the Hasidim. Just to give you one example, a clear illustration of this, there's a sefer called Sefer Matamim. It's a 19th century text. And it records what it terms a well-known reason for the practice of abstaining from Torah study on Christmas Eve. What's the reason? It shouldn't surprise us that the reason he gives is that Jesus should not get any benefit from our Torah study. That's why we refrain from studying. The same reason given by apostates 300 years before, 250 years before, is being given by a writer in Eastern Europe in the 19th century. What we have is an oral tradition that until the 19th century, if I'm not mistaken, actually the late 19th century, no Jews were willing to put down in print. By the late 19th century, Jews now are prepared to write down in print. In the 1880s, 1890s, whatever, they thought it was okay to write these things in print, that Jesus we don't study because he's going to get somehow helped by our Torah study. However, this is nothing new. The same explanations are being given 250, 300 years before by apostates. A Torah Shabbat, an oral tradition. A deeply ingrained oral tradition. It's obvious, to me at least, that there's no proof and no evidence whatsoever for any of the rational reasons that's been offered. It's impossible to imagine that Torah scholars would have stopped studying Torah, as Deutsch says, that because there was a merrymaking that night, that's why people play cards. Can you imagine great Torah? The Maharam Shik, by the way, who's a student of the Chasam Sofer, he didn't study Torah on Christmas Eve. Maybe he didn't know about the Chasam Sofer's letter, and numerous other great figures not study Torah. You're telling me that it's because of merrymaking, and in the first generations, they didn't study Torah either. That they, you're saying that they were taken in by some, by really the reason is because Jews stopped learning because of merrymaking, and therefore they invented these reasons ex post facto. First of all, the rabbis never would have gone for this. There's got to be a different reason for this. If Jews play cards on Christmas Eve, it's precisely because they weren't studying Torah. That's why they play cards. Now, the other, quote, rational reason that Jews were afraid to go out on this night cannot explain lack of Torah study either. As I said, we have no evidence that they ever shut down the Beit Midrash for public prayer. It makes no sense. Why don't Jews then study Torah at home? There's no evidence that Christmas Eve was the more dangerous, Easter was the more dangerous time. We have plenty of examples of attacks on Easter. Obviously, a Jew knows not to walk into a Christian neighborhood, but it wasn't regarded as the time, you know, what's wrong? If a Jew wants to walk around the Jewish neighborhood, we have no evidence that Jews, let's say, in the ghetto in Frankfurt didn't walk. If they needed to go somewhere, they had to walk to shul. They went to shul. Now that we have determined that the practice is not rational, but related to the supernatural, what exactly is it? What's going on here? Well, we do have sources that speak about when Jews pray, when they say Kaddish, when they study Torah, it helps with the dead, helps bring repose, stop the suffering to the dead. We also have sources that speak about the dead returning to Earth on some days of the year. Presumably, the notion that Jesus is spared punishment when Jews study Torah has to be placed into this context, which are all concerned about the fate of the dead and our human actions, how it affects them. It's possible there are other factors that were influential in the development of this practice. Yet since the abstention from Torah study is only one Christmas Eve practice that Jews engage in, and there are also other anti-Jesus and other anti-Christian practices that Jews engage in that night, since all, I think, would agree that the other practices can't be explained rationally. Some of you don't go in the latrine because Jesus is crawling in there. That's rational. There is no reason why the abstention from Torah study should be regarded any differently. There were other practices Jews did on that night also. It's also possible that the popular German Christian perception of Christmas as a dangerous time, there was a common German Christian belief, a superstition, that Christmas Eve is a dangerous time, given over to demons and ghosts. But this had some atmosphere in the German community, because I believe this practice begins in Germany. At least I first attested to there. We've seen already that Jews believed that Jesus' earthly punishments only occur on Christmas Eve, and that therefore Torah study is permitted after midnight. And many also permit marital relations after midnight. Well, maybe the origin of this is to be found in the popular Christian superstition, that the demonic forces that I just mentioned take effect and are present until midnight. Once midnight comes, midnight mass, etc., Christmas begins, they have no power anymore. I don't think it's too far-fetched to think that the Christians were afraid of evil spirits. Look at all the, in pre-modern times, you have plenty of Jewish superstitions, and many of them come right out of the Christian superstitions. The Christians believe in werewolves, Jews believe in werewolves. Christians believe in demons and mermaids and all these things, Jews believe in it. So if the Christians think that this night is a night of terrible things, of demons and everything, so Jews are also going to think it's a night. Of course, instead of attributing it just to the evil forces, they'll throw in Jesus, because he's one of the evil forces. That, to me, makes perfect sense. There's another, let me just mention in conclusion, another Christmas Eve practice of Jews. There was other practices in addition, one other one, which shows you that these all fall into the same sort of context. The practice on Christmas Eve was for Jews to read Aleinu out loud. So you say, big deal, read Aleinu out loud. Don't we always read Aleinu out loud? And on Shabbos and holidays, we actually sing it. But in many places in Europe, Germany and elsewhere, there was actually a law. The government banned the recitation of Aleinu. In other places, they actually said that you had to say it out loud because they wanted to make sure you didn't say the bad verse. Shehem yishtachli mohev avarik mipalim alel yoshia. For they bow to vanity and emptiness and pray to a God who helps not. The word varik, the gematria, equals Yeshu, Jesus. And Jews intended Jesus when they said this word, nothingness. And because varik looks like the Hebrew word for spit, many Jews would actually spit when they said that. Now, if you read the Art Scroll Siddur, they engage in some of this apologetics polemics, which I'm sure they know they're lying. They have to know it, I think. They're coming after coming. Because look at the first time this is mentioned in Shacharis. They say, this is a false accusation, etc., etc. It's not a false accusation. The Rishonim speak about how the word Varik refers to Jesus. So there's a whole history dealing with this prayer. And Jews generally would not say it because they were forbidden, or even when they weren't forbidden by law, the Jewish authorities knew that this could create troubles, so they told the Jews to say it quietly. The fact that we don't say that line today is because in certain places the non-Jews permitted Jews to recite it, but they made them take that line out. However, on Christmas Eve, the practice was to say it out loud. Where you'd say it out loud, you wouldn't say it out loud in synagogue, as far as I know. You'd say it out loud at home, but the idea was that at least once a year, you can say publicly the prayer that all Jews thought referred to Jesus. So I see it's already 10 after 10. There's more than we can say, but I'm going to turn up the light on my face a little bit so you get a little reflection, but I want to see the questions. And if you have questions, comments, I think we really have covered it. And in a nutshell, what we could say is that this is not some foolish practice by the Hasidim. This is not something that came about because Jews were afraid to go out at night, and therefore they, in order to give it some sort of religious meaning, they made up some phony reason. This is a practice that goes back to Jewish superstitions, Jewish fear of the demonic, and who is more identified with the demonic, with the Sitra Achra, than Jesus. That's the origin of this practice. So I'm not going to read back the old, thank you, by the way, Neil F. I'm not going to read through the old ones, so retype it again. The reason it wasn't accepted among the Sephardim is because they weren't living in a Christian society. By the way, Chaim Palachi quotes the Vilna, quotes the Besh about this idea that the marital relations on Nittel, but this isn't something anyone practiced. It was only Jews who lived in a Christian environment. This was their reality. Jews living in a Muslim environment didn't take this sort of stuff seriously. It wasn't part of their reality. And once mysticism dies down, once these ideas go away, no one in Germany is doing this anymore. It wouldn't make sense to them. In Lithuania, they're not doing it. However, in the Hasidic world, these sorts of ideas where Kabbalah and the mystical forces were so powerful, it remained with them. But Christianity wasn't a reality for Jews in the Muslim world. They knew nothing about it. It wasn't a real force for them. It was a theoretical thing, just like Islam wasn't a reality for the Jews of Europe. No connection is mentioned. They discussed this Tekuf of Tevet, which I didn't have time to get into now, which is very interesting. Well, what does the Tekuf of Tevet have to do with Jesus? I mentioned this in my article. I quote Professor Weisenberg, who mentioned Saturnalia and the calendar. I tried to get into that. It's quite complicated, but no, none of them mention that at all. Some of them, though, don't even mention Nittel. They just mention the Tekufa. The Tekufa of Tevet. That only works, obviously, for the Orthodox churches. But the Tekufa doesn't always fall out on Christmas in the Orthodox Church. And as we go through the centuries, it's not going to fall out. It's not exact. So Jonathan Baker is typing here. Oh, some people don't even refer to it as a minhag. They refer to it as halachos, hilchos. The Chasam Sofer was confronted with, it's a good question, Yisrael, he was confronted with a situation where everyone did it. And the reason being given, he thought, was nonsense. And therefore, he says, he offers a better reason. I think it's more than a limutzvos. He's saying that this is something we should do. I don't think he would have invented it on his own. However, he's saying that this is a practice, an old tradition. We have false reasons being given for it, but it's an old tradition. The Jews don't study Torah which means that they must be getting up and studying it later. And there were Jews who studied Torah later, because the issur of studying was only until midnight. The Chasam Sofer provides the justification for this. But it's more than a limud schos, because he recognizes that Jews should not be sleeping while the Christians are involved in their religious ceremonies. So I think that makes him an advocate of not studying Torah, but not studying Torah for a completely different reason. Jonathan. I don't know. I'm not sure what... you're saying the same Telemotar. The only person who could do something like this is Ravadi Yosef in Argentina. They asked him about it because for them the rainy season is different. And Rav Avadia Paskin that they should change it. Australia too. But there's no Sephardim in Australia. But in Argentina, they're all full of South America. They're all Sephardim down there. So they recite the prayers at a different time. The question is, does this refer to them or to the land of Israel? But it really refers to where you are. You're not praying for the land of Israel. But can anyone other than Rav Avadia Yosef, is there any Rav in the world who can give a psak? Remember, the practice in South America was to say the prayer for Geshem and things like when everyone else did, not to attain Tamata, to prayer for Geshem and all that at the same time as everyone else. And he altered it. So in terms of a sane Tamata, I don't know, you need someone like a Rav Avadia Yosef who can make that ruling. Only he could do that. No, he doesn't refer to it. The person who refers to Nitto and refers to no sex on Nitto, doesn't say Torah study, is Rafael Moldova's Chupar Katanim, which is in the middle of Christendom in the 18th century. He refers to that. It doesn't refer to Torah study, yeah, but clearly there's something going on there. They knew about at least part of the practice. While people are typing, I want to thank all of you for coming on tonight. It was a special event. Everything else is free, but wanted to do something special. Torah in Motion provides so many free services that it's nice that people are willing to step up for this. I don't know who the Italians are, certainly not in modern times. These practices would die out as soon as people become more rational, as soon as Kabbalah ceases to be a real force in Italy by the mid-19th century. Before then, I'm assuming they did certain of these practices. We spoke of Adi. Remember the classes on the Krach Shalromi? We're speaking about Kabbalistic practices. But any place where Kabbalah, where demons, where Sitra Achra is no longer part of your everyday life, these practices go by the wayside. And not only do they go by the wayside, you have rabbis who then say it's forbidden to follow these because it's Bittul Torah. Rabbi Griscott is writing. I'll wait a few more minutes. Anyone has more things to say about this? Yisrael. How they stopped it is, I think, what I'm saying, that in the Litvisha world, these notions, what we would call, at least most of us, these superstitions, these ideas, these quasi-mystical ideas, mythical ideas, of Sitra Achra, all that, these never became reality in the Litvisha world. They died out. What Rechaim of Volozhin did, the Vilna Gaon, I don't know, but these no longer were part of the reality. The reality for the Litvisha world was Talmud study. They didn't involve themselves in Kabbalah, they certainly didn't involve themselves in going to Rebbe's and getting Kameas. And speaking about demons, the Hasidim continue to write about demons and how to protect yourself from them and all that sort of thing. This is just not part of the reality of the Lithuanian world. Well, thank you, Rabbi Gruskut, and cordially invited to come and join with us when we start up our new semester. We've been doing now about 4 years almost, 3.5 years of the great Torah sages of modern times. For those who are new, you can download previous years as MP3s. And this year, by the way, you can see for only 99 cents Canadian, you can actually watch as a video, just like you're watching tonight, what we've done, not just me, but this semester, 7 others, many interesting topics. And spread the word in your shuls and to your friends. No one is doing anything like Torah in Motion. It really is head and shoulders above anyone else. It was the first one, started really the internet revolution in Torah study online, and they continue to be ahead of the curve. Of course, it takes money, so if anyone wants to donate or sponsor, but even better, go and download lots of classes, put them on your MP3 players, and that'll really help them out. Very nice, Jonathan. The Rugged Shover, Avadia, would you tell me? Doesn't tell me anything. The Rugged Shover learned on Tisha B'Av, when it's usher to learn on Tisha B'Av. And when they asked the Rugged Shover, how can you learn on Tisha B'Av, he said he can't help it, and he's willing to be punished for learning on Tisha B'Av. But learning on Tisha B'Av, learning Torah is more important than what the Halacha says. That's maybe a bit of the antinomianism we discussed this year in my Torah in Motion class. He's not the only one, by the way. When we do the Rugged Shover, I'll speak about others who learned on Tisha B'Av. But to tell me the Rugged Shover learned this night, that doesn't tell me anything, because the Rugged Shover, as I said, is willing to violate halacha, because for him, the study of Torah is worth more than halacha. From the Chazon Ish's perspective, none of this makes any sense. How can you violate halacha? Learn Torah. But for the Rugged Shover, he's not your normal, typical God of Yisrael, as we know. So Jonathan pointed out, I was Machaven. I don't know Jonathan, but I'm glad to say that We said the same thing. Okay, I'll stay on for two more minutes. I'm actually on my way early tomorrow morning to Florida to the show in Boca Raton. So I'm getting up very early, but I'll stay on for a couple more minutes. Rav Regensburg said the same thing about tonight, saying what, that you should learn Torah? I'm assuming Regensburg is a good Lithuanian Lithuanian Sharov, who, by the way, I will mention in my next semester on Torah in Motion, because we're going to be dealing with Rav Henkin and Rav Henkin's views about going into synagogues without mechitzas, which is a lot more liberal than you think, than most people would think. And I will get into Rav Regensburg's shita on this, and also the Rav shita. So we'll deal with Rav Regensburg. Okay, I see Jonathan Baker's typing. I will wait to see what Jonathan says, and then when I'm finished answering Jonathan, if I don't see any more typing, I will wish all of you. I'm not going to wish you a Merry Christmas or anything like that. But wish you that, as they say in my shul, the secular holiday tomorrow, you should enjoy your time off with your family. I know most yeshivas actually make tomorrow a day that the father can come in and learn with his son, things like that. So, all I could say, Jonathan, is please join us next semester when we deal with this issue. I think you'll be even surprised at what the Rav held. We all know what the Rav held publicly. Rav Shachter reports that the Rav's private position was not so strong as his public position about mechitzas. So stay tuned, God willing, and we'll leave it to Rabbi Kelman to schedule it, and we will talk all about this mechitza thing. Without giving all my hands away, the Rav calls it a d'oraisa, and yet he cites a verse from the book of Zechariah. I don't know. I never knew that you could have a d'oraisa, a Torah prohibition that comes from the book of Zechariah. But we will get into this. Okay, I see Levadia. Let's leave Levadia and Jonathan as the last ones, only because it's getting late and I have to be up at 4 in the morning. But please, anyone, feel free to email me, and I'll answer it as soon as I can get around to it. The chat was okay. I'll wait for Jonathan. Thank you. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for the questions. Thank you for coming out tonight, and hope to see you later. Thank you, Shalom, for all the technical support and tech support as well. Good night, everyone.